Welcome to Talking Success, the podcast series that focuses on everything fintech. I'm your host, Aaron Franks, and each week I'll be joined by a series of experts in the field who have a wealth of knowledge to share. Whether you're a seasoned operator or simply curious about the world of fintech, Talking Success is the perfect place to stay up to date on the latest developments in the industry. So sit back, grab a coffee, and let's start talking success. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Talking Success. We're carrying on the theme for the last few weeks about payments. Obviously, fintech and financial technology is a lot broader than just payments, but that's really what drives the ecosystem, certainly here in South Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. So I'm delighted to be joined by Kumaran Selvarajulu from the Banking Association of South Africa. We first met mid-part of last year at the FinTech Association launch. I think we were sitting next to each other and had some dinner. So it was nice to meet you. And then we've seen each other at a couple of events thereafter. So I'm delighted Kumaran can join us. I think just to sort of preface this conversation, I mean, over the last decade or so since I've been involved in the world of sort of fintech and payments, pretty much every event that I go to or have been to, I should say, there's always this banks versus fintechs and fintechs versus banks and fintegration and, you know, all of these kind of buzzwords that crop up. And I think, I mean, from a South African context, I think we're actually seeing that now. We're seeing sort of banks working really closely with fintechs. We're seeing fintechs acknowledge that they need banking partners in order to really, you know, be compliant and use the rails and use the, you know, the various different infrastructures that banks provide. So we're seeing a shift in dynamics, which I think is a fantastic thing. I'd love to delve a bit deeper, but before we do, perhaps you can give a quick 2-minute summary on who Kumaran is and what Banking Association is. And just tell us all a little bit more about you and Barsa.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Darren. Thank you for inviting me onto this. It's an absolute honor to be on the show with you. And every time I see you, you seem to be running around coordinating something for the FinTech Association. So I'll start with the Banking Association. We're a trade body. We are made up of member banks, and our purpose is very simply to represent the interests of the banks in South Africa. We do that by talking to various stakeholders, being aligned to South African need, where the country is going, and we do it as, you know, I love to say is that associations bring together the good and the vision and the purpose for industries. And I think we help with that. We help bring together the direction of the industry. We help articulate that with policymakers, regulators, with other associations like FINASA, with PASA, numerous associations. And I think it's particularly important to do that. Otherwise, it's just noise, right? And it helps towards building a vision statement, because we've got lots and lots of things that we want to do. But are we taking the country forward in 10 or 15? I'll talk about that more in 10, 15 years' time. I'll be long retired. So will someone have to pick up the mess that I've left if I haven't helped set up a foundation to take the country further? None of these things are solved in short, simple lifespans, right? They're all cross-generational things that take a long time to go. My personal experiences, I've been involved in banking and payments for about 25 years, I think, now. I used to be at PASA at some point in time as a counselor there. I worked for one of the large banks, First Rand Bank, as their subject matter expert for payments. But I hate the term expert, by the way. Knowledge changes too rapidly for anyone to call themselves an expert. So at this point in my life and career, I'm wanting more to be a change catalyst and to hand things over to the next generation.
Amazing. Thank you. Going on sort of that in terms of change, I was looking at the list of stakeholders or banks that you obviously represent at Barsa. And I was, obviously my eyes were drawn to the sort of the neobanks and the challenger banks. And we've got Time Bank there, we've got Discovery. I think I saw Bank Zero, but I can't remember. So we're seeing, you know, a lot of movement and a lot of evolving in terms of banking, certainly here in South Africa, with the neobanks and their digital banks. From a payments perspective, because I know that's the area that you focus on, is there any difference between the work that a fintech enabled, so a neobank or a challenger bank, does with payments versus a traditional bank, an Absa or an FNB, for example?
Yeah. So I'll start off by saying the banks are fundamentally different creatures, right? Any no two organizations can you look at them and say, well, these two organizations are going to do the same thing tomorrow. That's the nature of business. It's the nature of competitive advantage. It's the nature of human beings, right? We all do things slightly differently. The terms fintech, neobank, challenger bank, I find interesting because they tend to want to box things up into spaces. And I remember being at, I think, one of your conferences where Time Bank was invited, and it was very interesting for me because we'd just spoken about fintechs and Time Bank was brought up on the stage. And I go, when we actually move away from the labels and we look at what's under the hood, right, these things start seeming very similar and also very different at the same time. So, I mean, the challenges is maybe, a more interesting thing to focus on. You get the banks that have been around for a long time, who have the benefit of experience, but also have to carry fixed cost and infrastructure and things that they've got to take into the future. So they've got to sweat that out. But they do come with this practical understanding of this really complex environment. So, you know, they've built processes and they've stitched them together. Then you get the newer players, and this is true of any industry, right? You get the newer players that come in and they are able to engineer their architecture from scratch. Often the people that are in those environments have come from the legacy environments. So they look at the problems that were faced in those environments and immediately, right, start to say, okay, I've always wanted to solve this, right? But I couldn't do it on that mainframe. Now I'm going to do it in this new thing. And, you know, I suppose a simple thing would be to say, like, let's create a general ledger that looks at cryptos or something like that, right? But there's a balance between them, because on the one side, you've got this operationally resilient engine, right? And however you look at it, it is able to deliver the product, right? And we can say, yes, you know, it's old technologies and things like this. But when I'm asked to explain what the payment system is, I don't talk about computer systems. Right? What I talk about is a system that is resilient to almost 100% across different factories, across the entire country, that runs 24/7, 365 sometimes. And to which Six Sigma would seem like a real, real aberration, right? You couldn't possibly have 3.4 errors per million in the national payment system. Right? That would be crazy. But to build up that kind of low error rate, that's a diminishing return curve. You've got to invest in that over a huge period of time to be able to tweak all those rules and business practices and processes. So for me, the payment system is not about technology. It's about this operational success rate that it manages to do. Because that's the thing, that if it goes wrong, you know, everything goes pear-shaped. And yes, you have one or two incidents every now and again. But I can walk into any room and safely say, I bet you that no one in this room has not had their salary paid as far back as they can remember because of an error in the payment system. And I can do that because it is such a high success significance rate, right? It's so high that I can actually walk in and say, well, Darren, I can say to you that your salary's been paid and it doesn't go wrong. For me, that's the crux to this entire thing. We'll talk in a minute about fintechs and banks and all of that. I think they're wonderful. I have a huge amount of, I'll use the word excitement for the fintech industry, right? And I wish I was 30 years younger. I love what's going on. I love the new ideas. I love all of them. But we mustn't see it as simply an end state that we're going to build Starship Enterprise and everything is going to be done. Because in doing that, what's the lag time to do that? And how long will that lag time take? And who, And which area of the economy or society gets, you know, held back because of that, right? There is a need to maintain our payment system, our banking system, any system, right? Healthcare, whatever it is. There's a need to balance the prerogative of supply and efficiency with the prerogative of increased dynamism, innovation, creation, all of these things. I think both can happen. I honestly think both can happen. I think both are happening, right? The question is now, you know, how do we pull this all together and take it forward? So I'm less about the end state and saying, you know, banks will win or fintechs will win. I don't think it's about that, right? There have been three industrial revolutions so far. Banks have started off as one thing on the left of an industrial revolution and emerged as something entirely different in terms of capital structure, markets, products, everything, right? So they are inherently very adaptive entities, right? Because they track the economy. They understand how to adapt to the changes in credit and the changes in flows of money, right? And they'll adapt to, you know, to CBDCs and things like that as well, because that's what banks are built to do. Surplus units go to deficit units, and they are able to you know, act as an economic function across the market. So my personal feeling is banks will adapt, right? But I'm not saying this particular bank, you know, will be X size in 5 years' time. I don't know, right? No one knows the answer to that. But I think banks are highly adaptive by nature.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
It was a masterclass event Friday, actually, in Sandton. And there was a gentleman from Nedbank, albeit he was there in his own personal capacity and not necessarily representing Nedbank. And he was talking about the sort of the evolution of not necessarily banks as we know them, so traditional banks, but neobanks and challenger banks. And sorry to come back onto that, but it's quite an interesting topic. On the fact that when they first came out, if you look at someone like a Revolut in the UK, it was first kind of effectively a wallet. I mean, it really didn't have much more functionality beyond that. What happened over time is they started bundling services on top of that. And then they came sort of unbundling. So actually, as a consumer, I want everything myself, and I want to go and shop around and have lots of different choice. And then the Revoluts of this world and Discovery are doing exactly the same thing, rebundling all of these sort of products together to enable the consumer actually to have one app and to be able to book my flights for Safair, to book my cinema tickets, to book whatever I needed to book straight onto, you know, using one portal or one product and service. And if you look at some of the banks, again, we can name because we're not giving any sort of favoritism here, but I'm a customer of FMB. And if I go onto FMB, you know, the amount of sort of options I've got just within my mobile banking is vast compared to where it was maybe 10 years ago. Certainly when I first came to South Africa 10 years ago, it was really basic. You know, I could make a payment and that was about it. Now it's a lot more advanced. So we're certainly seeing that. Now, would you say from a banking perspective, and I'm going to come on to payments now, because there's a lot of talk in the market, certainly when it comes to the SMME sector, about the world of acceptance, right? So can I accept, how do I accept payments as a merchant, as a micro merchant, or as a small merchant? And there's a big driver here towards the soft POS. So, you know, having your phone, your Android device, or even your Apple device, where you can tap a card and, you know, I'm the merchant and I don't need any other hardware. I did see that Absa have launched that. They've launched a soft POS product. I'm sure it was Absa. And I just wonder from your perspective, because I've heard it from a few other sort of people in the industry as well, that there's mixed views. Some are saying, actually, I think adoption is going to be really challenging because of the trust element. Am I going to be comfortable tapping my card on someone's phone? And others are talking, well, actually, this is kind of the revolution. This is the next step when it comes to point of sale payments, is actually I won't need a device. I won't need a terminal. I can actually use, a phone. Do you have a view on that? Again, your personal view, do you have one?
Yeah, I think banking, central banking is typically a supply side strategic environment, right? It delivers, it covers the entirety of the population. It delivers a huge amount of functionality. I think what we've seen in recent years is because technology has become so incredibly ubiquitous and available, but also at the same time, consumers want to do other things with their time, right? They're becoming a lot more business active. When you talk about the SMMEs, they all start off as an idea in a person's mind, and it's that path to fruition or that path to commerciality that is so important, right? And countries that can enable that to happen faster and more efficiently whilst keeping the bad guys out, to my mind, are countries that are specifically, not looking at any particular technology or anything like that. They're positioning themselves really well, right? So, because I think what we're finding is this amalgam between the digital world and the physical world. And what we find is often there's a desire to extrapolate from one into the other. But I think this digital world is something entirely different, right? I think the countries that are beginning to understand this are not focusing on payments. They're not focusing on the elements of it, the silos. They're beginning to recognize, and I think the Indians might be getting this right, they're beginning to recognize the benefits of digital society and unlocking economic potential from the market, because we're playing in a big numbers game. Now, when you play in a big numbers game globally, locally, you have to generate ideas faster, because it's the only way you're going to keep up with the rate of pace of change. And by enabling the market, to enable the demand side to actually generate these ideas and allow the likes of fintechs and even SMMEs and whatever it is to pull together tools that allows that movement from an idea into execution, into generating a tiny little percentage of the GDP for the country, that's particularly important. So if it happens on virtual POS devices, however that happens, right, I think the Spartan model is really important. That's how the free market operates. You need trial, error, sometimes failure, sometimes success. And you need each generation to look at this and go, I'm going to do it slightly better, right? And I'm going to fix the loophole in this. That's how the model works. So when we come specifically into that environment, I think there's a huge amount of opportunity that is coming out of the cash environment, right? I think there's a huge amount of demand. And demand will drive supply, right? We have the taxi industry in South Africa, and say what we will about the taxi industry, it emerged from a demand, right? That was inadequately supplied. And so a new form of service emerged, right? And it's a resilient environment. Now, I've done lots, or the team has done, and I've had the benefit of being able to read it, lots and lots of research on cash and what the story of cash is. And it's essentially the story of the difference between digital and analog systems, right? The belief that you can simply replace an analog system with a digital system is highly flawed, right? It might happen, right? But it's not a one-to-one match. Since 1955, people are being saying this is the end of cash, it's disappearing. And what we learn is it's 2,500 years, it's incredibly rational, it's incredibly highly evolved. What happens in these markets needs a lot of consideration to business case, not just to technology. But how do you stitch it together? The acceptance that you talk about, it's not simply about one merchant accepting. It's about the ecosystem that merchant and his customers are in, because that merchant is also a customer somewhere else, right? That merchant is making his break-even or profit line based on a certain amount of cash coming through, a certain number of customers that are loyal to him because he works in a certain way. Now, I'm a great lover of digital society. I think it's incredible. I've been playing with ChatGPT. I can't get enough of the thing. It's amazing, right? But I look at it and I say, I'm not this smart, right? But I have a 5G connection and I'm able to access this tool. And if you put me in the room with someone who doesn't have that, yes, I am smarter than they are, right? So that now, there's supposed to be an economic, you know, one of the truths of economics is that technology is supposed to increase productivity. Right? But we're not seeing that overall. What we're seeing is there's a correlation between technology adoption and the digital divide, right? And that's dangerous. It's very dangerous because ultimately that places society in a position where you go, we've got to address this, right? But what do you do? Roll back the technologies? So you've got to start off with this vision and purpose in mind, right? You've got to start off by saying, what is the South African problem statement? What are we trying to do? Right? And I will maintain, I'm a programmer. There are very few things that technology can solve. And if you've got a bad business case, it will remain a bad business case. The technology is not simply going to transform this into a good business case. Right? So the short part of this is there is a complex, highly evolving ecosystem out there where there's different demands and where people are going, we want convenience, we want things to happen, but we also want to be protected because we're not going to think of you when it goes right. Right. But the second it goes wrong, you know, I'm going to reach out to whoever I can and say, well, you broke the sacred trust that I placed in you, right? Because that's what I expected. Right? I expected it to happen 100% of the time, every single time. So we've got to keep this balance, right? And it's the old world and the new world because you get the operational experience, and I'm not consigning legacy banks into the old world because the biggest IT shops in the country, are the banks, right? So, you know, when we talk about new technologies and stuff, banks have laboratories, they have the ability to generate technology. If you had to ask for sort of blockchain experts or experts on payments and things, you would most likely get people who know their stuff coming from out of the banking industry. What I am saying is that it is very important to put the vision ahead of the product sales because it's possible. We could do anything. We could sell green cigarettes tomorrow. But what do we really want to do? And I think this is something that we are faltering a little bit on in South Africa.
So from a South African context as well, I know a lot of our listeners are from other parts of the continent and internationally, but when we had Geeta on from the Payments Association, I think one of the big stats that South Africa is very proud of is that 80% of the population is banked. And that's a great stat. But when Geeta was unpacking that and she said, whilst 80% is banked, a large proportion, and I forget the number, simply use mm-hmm. to deposit their salaries and then the next day withdraw. So that the funds come out of the ecosystem, so it goes from effectively digital back to analog again. To enable those ecosystems that you talk, very passionately about, to enable those ecosystems to thrive and for digital payments to really take off here in South Africa, how does one go about keeping those funds in a digital form rather than it being taken straight out in analog format and then being used sort of in the informal markets to go and purchase goods and services?
So I think that it's the move to an absolute digital world is going to take some time. I think in South Africa, it's going to probably take a bit longer than in many other countries because we do have a highly cash dependent population. Right? I'm an advocate of technology, but I'm not an advocate of taking away people's ability to access goods and services. So what cash is it's a universal financial mechanism, a store of value and a payment mechanism. And it's very powerful in that regard. Now, some countries, like China, for example, might be able to move faster in that space. But we are structured differently. You know, we have a very interesting political ideology and constitution that says everyone goes on the journey together. Right. And we are also, we don't simply say or dictate, this is what's going to happen. Now, an interesting anecdote for you is I spent some time, who hosted the Swedish bankers and fintech and business associations, I think about a year or two ago. In 2017, Sweden, which is arguably in the top five most advanced countries in the world in almost every indicator, in 2017, Sweden predicted, the scientists in Sweden predicted an end of cash by 2023 in Sweden. When I spoke to the Swedish counterparts, I said, okay, how is that doing? How well is that going? And they said, nope. They've had to backtrack on this. And in this highly advanced country of only 6 million people, where their form of a social grant is literally to give extra money from the tax receipts back to citizens, right? They had to put the brakes on that and, in fact, actually move in the opposite direction, where the regulators had to come in and say, no, cash will remain available to those who want it. Now, you know, if I'm not saying Sweden is a better country, but if we look in terms of states of advancement in certain things, right, Sweden is an advanced economy. If Sweden is at that point, right, why would anyone make the assumption that we could simply move away from cash anywhere else? And empirically, it's not been happening, right? We heard immediately after, shortly after cards were introduced in the United States, there was a huge thing saying, well, that's it, that's the end of cash, it's gone. Right? We then heard in 2007, The Economist magazine said, we predict the end of cash. Right? And why is it that it is so difficult empirically? Or why has no one actually arrived at that point yet? Even in China, there's still cash. And we're talking about a very different type of system than we have in South Africa. Right? So I think what is important is to move away from cash, but do it on a graduation path so that people are taken along the journey and we don't create an exclusion from the digital environment for groups of people, which happens, right? I have a smartphone and I've had a smartphone for 20 years. So what that means is I have access to things that people who don't have access to smartphones have, right? I have fiber in my home. But we've got to be on that path. And it's got to be part of the vision is to say, let's take everyone on this journey. So I don't see cash disappearing in a long while in South Africa. But I do see huge improvements happening in that side of the market, right? I do see the fintechs, the cash book management, the ability to help businesses become more risk averse or more entrepreneurial. I see all of this happening. And you'll see the banks are doing similar things as well. Is they're not just providing products anymore. They're now saying, well, how can I de-risk the customer in his entrepreneurial venture? So the SMME is not just, well, here's a loan, take it and go with it. How can I help you make that into a success? Because that's what business is, right? You don't want to be in business, take a couple of short profits and walk away from it. You want to be in a nice long-term business that creates something institutional over years. And that's what we're seeing. That's what I'm seeing the banks doing is they go, and definitely the fintechs. I mean, you know, they go into these environments, they look at it and they say, okay, I can get the business tomorrow. That's easy. The technology is sexy. It does everything. You swipe left and something happens and all of that. Can I hold on to that business? Right. And if that guy I've given business to, how much more value to me is it? If his revenue base, if his turnover, if I form a partnership with him and his turnover actually becomes something huge after a while. So it's not a sausage factory. It's nurturing, right? It's creating something. The economists will call it value creation. It's very, very important. And value creation is incredibly important in Africa because it's what generates it generates money out of 1.3 billion people. In a good way, right? It's the good way of generating money out of the population.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of Talking Success. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us for this fascinating discussion on all things fintech. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and have gained some valuable insights into the ever-evolving world of finance and technology. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their expertise and providing us with some amazing insights. We certainly couldn't have done this without them. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and stay tuned for more exciting conversations with experts in the field. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep talking success.